broadcasting from the Unshackled Studios in Melbourne. This is Wilms Front, brought to you by theunshackled.net. Now here's Tim Wilms.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's Wilms Front featured interview show on this Thursday, the 29th of July, 2021. We are live tonight on the Wilms Front YouTube and DLive channels, as well as, of course, on Entropy, where you can ask myself or my guest tonight a question, or even better yet, send through a super chat to support the show. It's 8:30 p.m. here in Melbourne, Victoria, where we are now in lockdown light, which means although we are not under house arrest anymore, masks are still mandatory everywhere and social interaction with others is still severely restricted. Up in Greater Sydney, things are much more grim with another record day of new cases, 239, and more lockdown rules, including increased fines. And with the Australian Defence Force on their way to Sydney, that was announced today. Yesterday, Gladys Berejiklian extended the lockdown for another 4 weeks. But everyone expects the city's lockdown to not end until mid-September at the least. While the COVID lockdowns and health fascism continue, our country remains under cultural attack on a number of fronts. The Aboriginal superstructure, as we call it at the Unshackled, as Longcore's division in Australia, which does little to actually improve the welfare of Aboriginal Australians and is more focused on symbolic measures and gaining itself more government and corporate funding. One of their catch cries is that we, the white folk, are living on stolen land. Sovereignty was never ceded is the new slogan, including of NAIDOC Week. The history of Aboriginal Australians' relationship with European settlers is complex, but overall it is a true statement that what European settlement has done is overall improve the welfare of Aboriginal Australians who in ancient Australia were hunter-gatherers. However, this fact of ancient Aboriginal Australian society was completely rewritten in Bruce Pascoe's book Dark Emu, which since its publication in 2014 was embraced by Aboriginal activists, the ABC, state government education departments who are having a talk to children, and the federal Aboriginal Affairs Minister, Ken Wyatt. Dark Emu has now been exposed as one of the greatest literary hoaxes of the modern era, with its historical fiction now being acknowledged by mainstream historians, Peter Sutton and Karen Walsh, in their written critique, Farmers or Hunter-Gatherers, the Dark Emu Debate, which was published by Melbourne University Press last month. But it took a lot of brave truth-tellers and whistleblowers to expose the Dark Emu hoax. One of those is Roger Akaji, who is the founder of Exposing Dark Emu. He is my guest on tonight's show to talk about Dark Emu and its author, Bruce Pascoe's Rise and Fall. Roger, welcome to Wilms Front.
Hello, how are you, Tim? And hello, viewers. It's good to be here.
I'm not too bad, thank you. We're sort of, what is it, things, you're in Melbourne, such as myself, where we're both living under the same regime, as I said, lockdown light. So things are still pretty, I would say, not good, but not as awful as could be.
Yeah, I think at least we can get around a bit. But the big worry is this the last lockdown, or is there more coming? So I think we just mentally got to get used to another year or so, probably, of this.
Yeah, the next, what is it, incursion or mystery case, we'll probably brace ourselves again. But let's focus on what's your area of expertise. You've been one of the, you would say, frontline people who's really put their neck on the line to expose Dark Emu and Bruce Pascoe. You're not as well known as, say, somebody like Andrew Bolt, but you've certainly achieved a lot. But we'll start because not all of my audience will know exactly who Bruce Pascoe is, what Dark Emu is. We'll start there. So who is Bruce Pascoe and what is Dark Emu about?
Well, Dark Emu is a book. I've got a copy here. It's just a book that Bruce Pascoe wrote in about 2014. I think he published it. And the story is he published it, and I think the publishing, he says he went to quite a few publishers and no one accepted it. And the only publisher, or you know, one of the ones that did accept it, was Magabala Books in Western Australia. And they didn't think it would go that well. So they printed, I think, a first print run of about 800 copies in 2014. And so what's it now? 2021. So by 2021, it's had a print run of Dark Emu, and there's a junior version, Young Dark Emu. What they're saying now, it's well over 300,000 copies, right? Which for Australia is phenomenal. You know, if you're a well-known author and you sell 40 or 50 or 60,000 copies, you're doing well. So 300 is phenomenal. So if you assume they 300,000, maybe each copy is read by two or three people, right? So it's perhaps a million Australians that might have read it. So it's not overwhelmingly the majority, but it's a lot of people, right? So it did really, really well. And so what happened in about 2016, it started to get a lot of awards. I think Bruce Pascoe got the New South Wales Government Literary Award. A lot of people came out of the woodwork and were promoting it on the ABC, at universities, at writers' festivals. So it got a lot of traction, right? And then how I came across it was I went to a friend's place in 2018 and she had it on her coffee table. So I just picked it up and I read it, and because I like history. And I was actually fascinated because like a lot of people say, why wasn't I told? Why hadn't I heard about this history, right? That Aboriginal people were farmers. They weren't just hunter-gatherers. You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so that's the education I got. And I said, this is incredible. So I read the whole book in one weekend, right? And then something sort of ticked. It sort of said, well, you know, how come we've had 200 years of academics, anthropologists, we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars training people, and they've all come back and said it's Aboriginal societies were hunter-gatherer societies, right? Highly complex hunter-gatherer societies, but nevertheless, they weren't farmers. Whereas Bruce Pascoe said they lived in villages of 1,000 people. They planted crops, they tilled the soil, they had stored grain, they lived in stone villages. So this is not the Australia I know. So then I just sort of threw the book on the table and thought, oh, well, you know, it's okay. If adults want to write these things, it's a free country. And then probably about 2 months later, it was announced that it was going to be put into school. So this book was being done, Young Dark Emu, right? And then the sort of the penny dropped for me, because then I could see it wasn't just a straight history book. It was ideological. So I really got really upset, because you can't indoctrinate our children, right? So if you write a book for an adult can do some critical research and go and study a few things. And if it's rubbish, well, an adult can cope with that. But you can't teach an 8-year-old kid or a 9-year-old kid something and expect them to do critical thinking, because they don't think like that. If the teacher tells them that Aboriginal people were farmers and they lived in stone villages, the children will believe it. So then I got really angry. So I started doing a website. I just started my own website and I started going through Pascoe's book. And initially I found a few mistakes, but then I found some really bad mistakes where he'd actually manipulated the data. So he'd left out words, he'd put other words in, he twisted it all around. So it was, a lot of it was just made up, a total fabrication. And that's why we'd never heard about this before. So Bruce Pascoe says he discovered this. So hundreds or thousands of people before him never discovered it, but Bruce goes into a secondhand bookshop, like he says, gets the journal of Thomas Mitchell, reads it, and then suddenly realises Aboriginal people were farmers. So it was all about manipulating. So that's when I started, right? So that's sort of how I got onto it, and I just started building from there. And Bruce Pascoe himself, I think he's probably in his 70s now, but he's an Aussie like us. He grew up in Richmond. I think he lived on King Island for a while. He was a writer of fiction. And then once we got into it, we found out the critical time for him was he'd been writing a lot of fiction. He's sort of okay as a writer, but never really made the big time. And then 1988, he wrote a book, and he had it reviewed by the Canberra Times, the newspaper. And the book was about a young man finding out that he's actually Aboriginal. He was Indigenous. He didn't know. And the book's a fiction book about how he copes with finding out he's got Aboriginality. And the reviewer, I think her name was Veronica Sen, she wrote the book and she said, Bruce, you know, it's a really good book, but, you know, as we all know, because you haven't had the lived experience of an Aboriginal man, you can't be that authentic, right? And an Aboriginal writer would be much more authentic, right? Now, it's only my opinion, it's only an allegation, but I think that he dropped for poor Bruce then. I think he realised that if he was going to have a big breakthrough and if he wanted to write about Indigenous items, Indigenous books, it would be better if he was Indigenous. So he went off on a trek. He went looking through all the records and he says he found Aboriginal ancestry. And I think he was in his 40s, he said. And then from about his 40s on, he found more and more elders said they knew his family. And then his persona developed from then there. So he actually claimed Aboriginality to a few tribes and whatever. And that's where it started with him, right? So that's pretty much the background. So is that all right, or not?
When did you start the Dark Emu Exposed website? What year?
So 2018 I started, right? And I think I was the first to start, but quite independently there was a writer, Peter O'Brien. He wrote this book. This is his version. He started about the same time as me. We didn't know each other. So he started, I think, in 2018 too. So it clicked somewhere else. So 2018 was the time because it really started. Once it gets into schools, we all notice, right, because we know people that got school kids or whatever, and that's when a lot of pushback came against the book.
And you said it took off when it won all of these state literary awards, which they're all government-funded and government-sanctioned. I mean, they're called the Premier's Literary Awards.
Absolutely. So you and I are paying, Tim, and your viewers are paying, right? So we're paying
and
for it all.
We have paid to promote Dark Emu to make it the world sensation that it became.
Absolutely. So the ABC, he was on the. I just had a look. I think last week I had a check, but he's been on the ABC. I'm guessing maybe 10, 12 times from 2014, 2015, 16, 17. And he goes on shows like, you know, Virginia Trioli or Patricia Karvelas or The Book Show or whatever, and they have it, or Jonathan Green, and they do interviews with him. And it's a way of, the ABC is not meant to promote products, but to me it looks like they're promoting a book. And that's fair enough in a way, but it certainly helps a lot to get out there when you get promotion by the public broadcaster to broadcast book.
Now, I first heard of the Dark Emu controversy it was back then when, Josephine Cashman, who at the time was on Ken Wyatt, the Aboriginal Affairs Minister Senior Advisory Group for Planning the Indigenous Voice to Government, she went public to say that this Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu book is not history. And she was, when I saw her first on the Bolt Report, she seemed mad as hell that how dare my people's history be rewritten in this way and then taught to the younger people this history, which is not my people's history. She became quite, I would say, like she really put forth the because there are Aboriginal activists outside of what we call the superstructure That's what we call it here at the Unshackled, who want to see real life, the real life welfare of especially those in remote Aboriginal communities improve. And I think she really was able to communicate that it was sort of like so the way I read it is like, how dare he do this? And she blazed onto the scene, and that's when Andrew Bolt, who's been quite battered over the years in the history wars when it comes to Aboriginal issues, including being taken to court for a column where he talked about the mixed Aboriginal ancestry of several Aboriginal activists. He's remained steadfast in his argument that the stolen generation, there was never a child who was taken from a parent purely for racial reasons. So him willing to sort of enter this, because it is a huge claim to make about an historical book, that no, this is not true, especially when it was a juggernaut.
Yeah, so there's two aspects to this. There's the history, like Bruce Pascoe's book, right? So you can judge the book on its merits, right? He's right. It's, to me, it's like some of your viewers will know Eric von Daniken's Chariots of the Fire, right? So he said aliens came down and built the pyramids and everything, right? So it's enjoyable to read, but we all know it's rubbish, right? So that's the side of Bruce Pascoe's book. The trouble is, there's a lot of, 99.9% of Aboriginal people, they know their history, right? And it's terribly derogatory to tell some people that they were something that they were not. Aboriginal people are very proud of being hunter-gatherers, right? They're brilliant. You know, they're probably one of the best hunter-gatherer societies in the world, because it's very hard to live in Australia. They've lived here for 50,000 years. It's the most inhospitable of continents. You and I, if we had to live here off the land, we'd probably last 2 weeks, right? So it's a highly skilled, complex society that they had, living as hunter-gatherers, and some people say hunter-gatherers fishers now, or complex hunter-gatherers, because, you know, they had fishing nets and they did have stone weirs to catch fish. They used poison to put in water poles to kill fish and to kill emus. So it's pretty complex, right? But he's saying, no, we're going to pretend that you're farmers, therefore you're like us, you know, you're sophisticated, right? As if hunter-gatherer people can't be sophisticated, right? You can actually be a sophisticated hunter-gatherer. You know, agriculture is a different thing. It's more complex in many ways, but it's complex to be a hunter-gatherer as well. So Josephine's saying that. And so a lot of Aboriginal people were deeply hurt, because they're saying that Bruce Pascoe is taking who we are from us, you know, and that's cultural appropriation. And so Bruce Pascoe thinks he could do it because he says he's Aboriginal, right? So Josephine was getting really upset with that, and not just Josephine, but lots of Aboriginal people. And we used to get a lot of emails from Aboriginal people saying, Roger, you've got to do something about this, because many Aboriginal people are very gentle, polite people, and it's very bad form to contradict other Aboriginal people in public. But they would feed us information and say, look, Bruce Pascoe's wrong here. Here's some more information. And so people like me can go out and get our heads smashed in, right? And we can get away with it. In a sense, we can often say things which Aboriginal people are thinking, but they're too polite to say. So that's the technical side. But then on the other side, and we didn't start this, but out of the blue, I work in a network. I started by myself, but I found a lot of other people around Australia beavering away on this. And so in the end, I connected into them through Facebook pages and whatever, and they all came up. So we ended up with about 20 or 30 people around Australia, all doing little bits and everything, finding information. And we got access to people who are genealogists, right? And we were getting information that, maybe Bruce Pascoe is not as Aboriginal as he thinks. So we did a lot of work in that. And, you know, you've got to be careful what you say, because but basically we can't see from the evidence where Bruce Pascoe has Aboriginal ancestors, right? And Andrew Bolt has presented a lot of that. And Bruce Pascoe says he's got the paperwork, he's got the information to show he is Aboriginal, and he never presents it, right? That it's a very topic, bad subject when you have to, when you talk about people's ancestry and everything. It's very touchy, right? So technically, Bruce Pascoe can call himself Aboriginal. I don't care. No one really cares. He can be, he can believe he's Aboriginal. He can be accepted by Aboriginal people, and that's fine. The warning bells go off in Australia if you then put your hand out and say, I want a benefit, I want something because I'm Indigenous, because I'm Aboriginal, right? And so we have what's called the three-part rule in Australia. So that you have to satisfy the government, that the three parts. You've got to be identified as an Aboriginal yourself. You've got to be recognised by an Aboriginal society or group or family that you're Aboriginal. And you have to have some descent. Now, descent means, you know, one of your relatives, it doesn't matter how far back, has to be a known Aboriginal. That's the three-part rule. And that we have that. So if you go to the government and say, I want funding for an Indigenous Writers Award, the government says, and should, it, that's the law, that, all right, you prove that you're Aboriginal, then you can go in the competition and you can get the funds. And a lot of people are saying that Bruce Pascoe doesn't satisfy that three-part rule, right? Now, I'm not saying one way or the other. I've just seen some information. And Bruce has never, Mr. Pascoe has never come out and said, here's the evidence. So what upset Josephine and a lot of other Aboriginal people is there's a lot of Aboriginal writers out there who are trying to get up the ladder, and they see people who are collecting money, you know, tens of thousands in grants and prizes for Aboriginal, for being Aboriginal writers, and they're a bit suspicious. They don't think it's true, right? And they don't like it, and it's not really fair. If you're going to put your hand out and get something because you're of your indigeneity, you have to make everyone comfortable that you are Indigenous, right? So it's not for us to prove that Mr. Pascoe's Indigenous. It's for him to satisfy everyone else that he is Indigenous, and then the things come. So that's where people like Josephine, and Josephine stuck her neck out and she did all that, and the powers that be all came down on her and made her life very hard, right? So I think Ken White got her off the board that she was on and whatever.
Yeah, very
so there's a lot of powerful forces in Australia. If you don't toe the line, things that can go against you, right? So that's the issue, and we all have trouble with that. So all the Aboriginal people I know, they all agree that if you want to get something for because you're Indigenous, you have to satisfy the people giving you something that you are Indigenous, right? And a lot of people say Mr. Pascoe hasn't done that yet. So that's where that controversy is all from. So there's a historical side, and then there's the indigeneity side, right? It's always touchy to talk about people's history and their ancestry, right? We shouldn't have to talk about it, and we shouldn't. We only need to talk about it when you put your hand out to get something from the taxpayer.
Why did, why do you think Bruce Pascoe felt the need to rewrite ancient Aboriginal Australian history? But why, the more important question, why did the established Aboriginal activists, the superstructure as we call it, why did they embrace his new history so much? Why was it so important to turn the history on its head, right, to say, no, Aboriginals were not hunter-gatherers, they were agriculturists? The way I interpreted trying to build up that ancient Aboriginal Australia was some sort of ancient Rome. Why was this new historical narrative, why did they embrace it so much? Why, right, what were they wanting to achieve?
There's two forces at play here. The first one is white Australian guilt. So the narrative has been changing over time. So that when I grew up, the narrative was that Aboriginal people were had to be brought into our society. And we use the word assimilation. It's not a nice word now. People say integration, right? So they had to be brought in. So on day one in 1788, they didn't get anything special, right? Because, you know, they couldn't speak English. You know, our cultures didn't understand. But over the 200 years, we've slowly improved all the time, such that I think one of the last big change was 1967, when they were brought up to complete equality, and then we've had native title and whatever. So the whole idea of Australian society over 200 years is, and we might not have done it perfectly, but basically we've been going forward to bring up Aboriginal people to equality within Australia, right? And that was the narrative we're on. But in the last, since the 70s, 80s, the last 20, 30, 40 years, there's a political narrative where we're being made to feel guilty for what happened to original Aboriginal society, because it did collapse, right? And that's terribly sad, but that's what happened. So to atone for our ills, for stealing the land and whatever, we have to feel guilty and give something back to Aboriginal. So there's a whole section of white society, who a lot of people bought this book and didn't read it, right? So it was a moral statement. You went and bought it, you might have flicked through it, and then you put it on your coffee table. So when your friends in Fitzroy come around and see you, oh, you've got dark emu, you know, you're part of the woke set, you know, you're atoning for our ills. It's like virtue signaling, right? There's that side of it. And that's one of the reasons why it's so popular. And even people like Stan Grant, he's written about it. He said, even though it's rubbish, he said white Australia believes it because they want to believe it, right? They want to feel that, oh, Aboriginal people were sophisticated. They did have democracy. They did live in villages. They weren't hunter-gatherers, nomads, living a very materially simple life. Like Aboriginal people had materially very simple, but they were highly complex in terms of kinship and family and in terms of religion and art. So they didn't put their effort in like we do. We put our effort into material things, you know, cars, planes, food, houses. They put their energy that they had every day, they got enough to eat, but then they put their energy into their art, their family, their kinship, and their sort of spirituality, right? That's where they put their effort, right? So there's those people doing that. But then, and so that, so you can, I don't really feel that bad about middle class urbanites who want to atone for the sins of the past. I don't agree with it, but they can do that. But then the other big group, that mainly the political activists, right? This is what the Uluru Statement is about and the Voice is about. It's not about to make life better for Aboriginal people in remote areas. It's a core group of Aboriginal activists. They actually want to get into the Constitution. They actually want to make the seventh state of Australia, right? And they want an Aboriginal state. They want seats in the House of Representatives, seats in the Senate, and then in another 50 or so years, they want to go for sovereignty. They want to get a seat at the UN. They want Australia to split into two or more countries, the old Australia and then Aboriginal states, right? Now, they've been trying to manoeuvre around that, but the trouble is legally, Australia is 100% legally correct, right? So it was a settlement. It wasn't a conquest. The activists try and make it look like an invasion and everything, but it was a settlement. The world recognises Australia as a settled colony, right? It was formed as a federation in 1901, the Commonwealth of Australia. So legally for the last 30 years, Aboriginal people have been trying to attack the core foundation of Australia, and they haven't been able to get away with it. They haven't been able to change anything legal. So what they want to do now is change the young voters. They're working on this generation of kids who become the voters in the next 30 years. They want us to think that we stole the land illegally from Aboriginal people because Aboriginal people were really farmers. If they had been farmers, we should have signed a treaty. So they actually had sovereignty. They worked the soil. So mentally, the activists are trying to use, they're using dark emu as like a wedge to show that the British made a mistake. They should have realised it was Aboriginals had sovereignty here, therefore we have to give sovereignty back. We've got to sign treaties, and that's what's happening now. We're getting treaty processes all around Australia. So they've suffered a bit of a knockback because Bruce Pascoe was their main battering ram, and now he's fallen in a heap. So hopefully that's made the whole process a bit harder for them, right? So that's where the push was coming from. That's why it was popular. That's why there's a hardcore activist who are pushing it on the ABC. They're pushing it in universities. They're pushing it in Canberra. They're pushing it through, like Marsha Langton, you know, she's on the Voice Committee, and she stood up. She's an anthropologist and said, yep, Bruce Pascoe's right. She's pushing it because, in my opinion, politically, it helps her political cause to show that the British dispossessed the Aborigines who were really farmers, and we made a mistake, so we've got to give it back to them. That's the theory.
It definitely sounds to me that by putting forward the narrative that ancient Aboriginal Australia was this sophisticated agricultural society, that to really up the white guilt, like, wow, like you, like the European settlers destroyed a well sophisticated ancient society. So to build up that Australia was invaded, that's certainly what it seems to be, and that certainly is how you see it as well. But historical reconciliation process, which, well, we're now at the stage now with the Uluru statement from the heart. These activists, they've always never been satisfied. Like the 1967 referendum to remove the part of the constitution that excluded Aborigines from the census. After that, we had, what is it, native title. Then there was saying sorry to the stolen generations, and the recognizing ancient Aboriginal Australia in the constitution. People might not remember, was actually a election proposal by John Howard in 2007, and then it's been bubbling along since. Not much happened during the Rudd-Gillard years, and not much has happened through the Abbott-Turnbull Morrison years, because, well, they know that they have to make sure that if there is a referendum that it's successful, because only 8 out of 43 Australian referendums have been successful. But of course, the Aboriginal activists, as soon as this referendum proposal gained more traction, the recognise campaign that the AFL Qantas support is like, hey, we've already got enough support for that. And that's when they went for the Uluru statement from the heart to have a voice to parliament, which is, well, they're trying to get more sovereignty of their own.
Yeah, that's right. So it's that's the political side, right? So that's how that's coming. But I think you'll find it's in the whole world now. It's the whole concept before was there was inequality in the world, right? So minority groups were often oppressed, disadvantaged, and our society has come to recognise that pretty much over the last 50, 70 years. And we've brought all those minority groups up. And that's homosexual, it's lesbians, it's gay guys, it's Aboriginal people, it's migrants, right? So the whole idea is to bring those people up to equality with what we call mainstream Australia. The trouble is there's a certain number of activists in there. They want to go beyond equality. So what within this particular case, so in terms of the voice, what that actually means is that Aboriginal people will get two votes. So they'll vote for their local member like you and me, but then they'll have a separate stream of democracy where they vote for their own people who then get into parliament and get a second bite of the cherry on legislation that's going through. So Aboriginal people want to go beyond, well, not all Aboriginal, but Aboriginal activists want to go beyond that. They want extra things, right? And you sometimes see that, you'll see that in, the gender wars, that women have been fighting for equality, all those years. They're finally getting equality, but now there are men coming in as trans men, trans women, whatever, coming to hijack the thing and actually overtaking where women were and trying to push women back. So it's a worldwide, like a woke problem. It's a worldwide thing, right? So, but in this particular case, that's what that angle is. So just to go back a bit on the stealing Aboriginal authenticity, that's where this new book, these academics, these are the ones that really, so people like me and Andrew Bolt, we can bang on and we'll appeal to
a certain Peter portion O'Brien, of because population. Yeah, his book was published by Quadrant Books, which is
Quadrant, right? He was the first one, but because he's from Quadrant, we all, they get a bad press, right? So when you get two left-wing academics come out against it, and they're from Melbourne University Publishing, right? That's when it really, the whole thing caved in for Bruce Pascoe. So the whole dark emu thing was coming along, and it was struggling because we were holding it back a bit. But the fatal blow was when the left-wing academics came out and said what Bruce is saying in there is totally wrong, right? And that's what killed it for him, right? And that's where that's pretty much, I think we think it's going to be the fatal blow, right? So despite, even though they're only saying what we were saying, but because we're from the centre-right, you know, the centre-left people won't believe us. But someone from the left is saying it now. It's in the Age. It's in Crikey magazine, Crikey Online. So now it's pretty much there's a whole lot of people that have come out as critics of Bruce Pascoe from the left to the centre to the right, and that's why that'll end, right? So that's why it's a big political blow to the Uluru statement and the Voice and that whole momentum. So you might have noticed it's all sort of dying a bit dead in the water, like the Voice and the Uluru statement. It was really a hot topic, what, 2 years ago, whatever, but it's all really slowed down because everyone has worked out the sort of the political machinations that have been going on, and they realise it's not in the best interest of the country. It's not a good deal for Australians.
But in the aftermath of the Melbourne University publishing book, you still had Ken Wyatt at the federal level, and the New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian was asked, well, given there is this growing evidence that dark emu is just not true, you're still going to teach it as historical fact in schools. And I think, what is it, Gladys Berejiklian said that, it's good to have these sorts of debates about history, because, of course, politicians, they never like to admit they're wrong or they've been hoodwinked, and they never like sorry is the hardest word for a politician or to admit that they got it wrong. We're seeing that quite a bit now. So they're still in the government education departments. Doesn't matter if it's liberal or Labor at a state or federal level. The education departments in particular have still got this, are still teaching it in schools as a historical fact.
Yeah. See, the part of the problem with our society, I think there aren't courageous people anymore. I mean, there must be some, but we're not as courageous as we used to be, right? So what happens is, I think Mark Latham put a motion to the Parliament in New South Wales to have young dark emu or dark emu taken out of schools, right? Because he's saying, it's false history, right? So, for example, if you're teaching the Holocaust, you don't let whatever his name is, David Irvine, come in and have his book, right, on such a sensitive topic as that, because, you know, there's history and there's history, right? You don't have every alternative view. We're paying millions of dollars for historians, for academics and everything to do their job to say what's right. So he put up a proposal to remove it. And I think from memory, only five people voted for it. Him, Fred Nile, and I think two of the three Fishers and Shooters Party, the Liberal Party and the Labor Party voted against his motion to take it out of schools. And my feeling is, so you said, Gladys just said, you know, we need it in schools. I got a feeling it's because she's got a million things on her mind, right? This is probably not the highest priority. And they're scared of social media. If she had to come out and say something, because everyone wants to be a virtual signal. So a politician comes out and wants to get through the day without getting on Twitter, being abused, having Facebook go against him or saying anything controversial. So it's safer for her to not stand up for the rights of school children. It's easier for her to say, oh, well, we'll just, you know, we need these views and let someone else worry about it. This is a big problem. No one's got principles anymore, right? And so that's what happens. And if you let this get in the schools, well, then other crap will get in, right? And the thing is, it's no coincidence that Australian children are falling down. I think I read the other day where, you know, so many years behind, our kids are so many years behind where they were 10 years ago because we're not teaching them properly. We're not being rigorous. We're letting all this mumbo-jumbo come in. Now, it might not be necessarily teachers' fault. You know, they're under a lot of pressure, but, you know, teachers, have to carry some of the blame, but so do parents. You know, if I was a parent, I would be going to my school and say, look, if you got this rubbish in your school, I don't want my kids reading this, right? So if you have a look at this, right, this is Young Dark Emu, right? If you look at the first couple of pages, right, you get in here, so the headings are like, you know, this is for 7 and 8 year olds, grab for the land, huh? What? One the land grab, right? So the land grab. Then you've got pictures of what else have they got? Oh, I can't find it. But you've got, oh, here it is there. So pictures of people shooting each other, right? They're a bit hard to see. But there's massacres, yeah, right? So you can't be a 7 or 8 year old children and get taught that your ancestors massacred Aboriginal people. Kids like that can't compute that.
And that's another disputed area of what you'd say European settlement history, the frontier wars. There's also been a lot of literature published disputing a lot of the alleged white settler massacres of Aboriginal Australians, going back to what is a quadrant. Its editor Keith Windschuttle has published a number of books on volumes of the fabrication of Aboriginal history.
Yeah, that's right. So what it is, there were lots of a lot of people say the narrative being pushed now was a frontier war. There were massacres here, massacres there. We were brutal. It should be a war. It wasn't peacefully settled. Whereas what other traditionally historians say, and Keith Windschuttle still says it, that basically, sure, there were skirmishes, there were clashes, there were fights between Aboriginal people and settlers. But in the scheme of things, in terms of the world, right, it wasn't a particularly violent settlement, right? So not like North America or parts of Africa or South America. So, and the thing is, it wasn't state sanctioned. So if you there are lots of cases where convicts and settlers were hung for killing Aboriginal people because it was illegal, because Aboriginal people were British subjects. So you it was illegal to kill them. It was illegal for them to kill you, right? So legally, so it's like Australia now. Australia is not, none of us would say Australia is a murderous country, but every day there's a murder here. Doesn't mean the country's murderous. It's illegal and whatever, and we try and stop it, and we do the best we can. And in colonial times, the government tried that. It tried the best it can to control it, not as effective as it should have been, and there was some appalling massacres and killings. But it's not state sanctioned. It's not genocide. It's not a Holocaust, right? And then you've got to look at the numbers. So people like Henry Reynolds say maybe 20,000 Aboriginal people were killed, and that's appalling. But in the scheme of things, out of a population of 300,000, and some people say there's 700,000, and you're having fighting on some of the frontiers right out in the bush, it's not a lot of people, right? And the thing is, and other people say, well, where's the evidence, right? So there's the documentary evidence. I think the University of Newcastle's up to about 6,000 people. 6,000 Aboriginals were killed from the literature, but no one really finds any bones. No one finds massacre sites. No one finds bullet hole wounds in bones. So we're not saying it didn't happen, but we're just saying maybe the scale of things wasn't as bad as the activists want us to believe, right? Because what they want to do, they want to get guilt. They want to get guilt into us to be responsible for something that happened 100 years ago, right? And so it's a political narrative. It's not a factual narrative, right? And the thing is, as a country, if we say, look, we fixed it all, we're not doing it again, that's the best we can hope for. We can't be held responsible for what happened hundreds of years ago, but we can be held, if we still did it, we should be condemned, but we don't still do it.
And I remember when the Aboriginal activists attempted to import what I call BLM 2.0 into Australia last year after the death of George Floyd. They got very upset when Scott Morrison said, well, Australia doesn't have a history of slavery against Aboriginal Australians. And then they started to promote this Australia had this widespread practice of blackbirding, which is not technically slavery, but it's still forced labour. So they tried to make that into a thing. Oh, we still had a form of racist slavery in Australia.
Yeah. So what it is, and Bruce Pascoe, he comes out, he said, oh, you know, with slavery because Aboriginal people were put in chains or whatever, right? But you've got to understand, there's a bit of history here, and this is why we get upset that the historians don't promote the good things. So Arthur Phillip, who the first governor of Australia, he actually wrote some papers, I think in 1785 or something, before Wilberforce. Wilberforce was the guy in England who actually abolished or promoted the work to abolish slavery. So Phillip, Governor Phillip was writing about there will be no slavery when he comes to Australia. He came to Australia and said there's no way known there's ever going to be slavery here. And I think I'm right in saying Australia is the only continent, the only country that's never had slavery. And so slavery, what happens is the postmodernists, the activists, they use word creep. They change the meaning of words that we have. So slavery to us, most of us, means what's called chattel slavery, where you can buy a person in a marketplace, they become your property. When they have children, the children of that slave become yours. So that's classic Southern American plantation slavery, right? That's what slavery is. Whereas Bruce Pascoe said, oh, we had slavery in Australia because we had the Kanakas, who were like the Nevans, the Vanuatu people coming from to work in the sugar cane, right? And they were originally, there was a few cases of blackbirding where they kidnapped Solomon Islanders and Vanuatuans and brought them to work in the sugarcane. But the Queensland government was dead against it and they kept fighting it legally. So only a small number came. And then the sugar growers started using what was called indentured labour. So they would go to Vanuatu or the Solomons and say, here's a contract, we will pay you, I think it's £3 a year. You would come on a contract for 2 or 3 years and then you would go back, right? Now, if it was that bad, you would expect that all the people that came here were so bad they would go to Vanuatu and they would never come back. There's heaps of cases where people signed up 2 or 3 times. So if it's slavery, would you re-sign? And we've got photographs. We're going to do a blog post on it, but they're on the boat coming here. There's some which are just as natives, but others have got hats on, clothes on. They love coming to Australia, working, and then going back to their village with all their goods and their money, and they were heroes. So they were the four, five, seven visa people of their day. And we're doing it now. We've got Samoans. We've got people coming here on visas and working for 6 months and then going back to Fiji and Vanuatu, and they whinge and moan. They're not getting paid enough, but they're still doing it. It's a payment. So there wasn't no real slavery like that. We never had slave markets. And the only case in Australia where someone was sold was, I think it was 1811, a settler sold his wife in Sydney, white guy, right? So he sold his wife and she wanted to be sold. So he put her up on a block, sold her for £1. The governor found out about it. They chased them down. They put them in chains, right, and they fined them, because they weren't allowed to do that. So in the colonial times in England especially, people sometimes sold their wives, right, to make a bit of extra money. So that's the only case we could find of actually someone selling someone in Australia, right? And even today, there's a bit of slavery. Last week, 2 Indian people went to jail for, I think, 8 years or 10 years for keeping a slave in their suburban home in Melbourne, right? It doesn't mean we're a slave economy, right? So in 100 years' time, people aren't going to come back and say, oh, Melbourne had slaves in 2021. Yeah, there was a slave, but it was illegal and the government jumped on it. And it's the same as the Kanakas. We never enslaved Aboriginal people. There were people in chains as convicts, you know, prisoners working, just like there were convicts in chains. It doesn't look good, but they weren't slaves. So it's all rubbish. It's all just manipulating our history to push a political, to make us feel bad, to make our children feel bad, to destroy the confidence of our children in our country. So people want to destroy our society. So that's why you have to stand up to it and just say, no, it's all rubbish.
So where do you see Dark Emu and Bruce Pascoe going in the medium-term future? Because obviously with what's going on in the country at the moment, there's other issues which are dominating the news cycles. But when the curve goes flat again, that's when these cultural issues come up again. I mentioned BLM 2.0 middle of last year. Then we had, what is it, Me Too 2.0 in Australia in around about March. And then we had, I think, another kids climate strike as well. So the reconciliation, whatever you want to call it, voice to Parliament, Uluru Statement, it will come back again. And it could be that the left, cultural left, they just cut their losses and say, let's just pretend Bruce Pascoe never existed, we'll just move on. Or he could live on like Elizabeth Warren did over in the US, when she, in her entire political career, claimed to be Cherokee Native American, and then decided she would take a DNA test, which didn't work out.
Yeah. But still so what will happen is, in my opinion, Bruce Pascoe will live on. Mr. Pascoe is a very good yarner. He's a good talker. He likes to spin a yarn. He enjoys being a writer, right? So what's happened over the last 4, 5, 6 months is a lot of Aboriginal people are disappearing from Bruce, right? So they're pulling out. They don't want to be associated with him. A lot of the ABC, you know, the more senior ones are not associating with him anymore. But what's happening is Pascoe's always gone to things like permaculture conferences, greenies. He's moving into with the Gaians now and sustainability crowd, right? So it's all this Mother Earth. So what he's starting to do now, he's trying to link his theories about using indigenous plants to care for Mother Earth. And I mean, so he's being drawn into that green sustainability, climate action, anti-capitalist Gaian area, right? Good on him. I don't care. I mean, that's fine. But that's where Pascoe and his Dark Emu will end up going. That a lot of the followers are quite happy with that. They're actually not. They don't really care about the Aboriginal side, but they want. They like the indigeneity of it. They like the soft footprint, right? No fossil fuels. We're all going to hug trees, hold hands. It's that sort of soft thing. That's where he's going now. So you watch over the next 6 or 12 months. So the political side with the voice and Uluru will keep going over here, but just I don't think Bruce will be in the group. And Bruce will be over here with the Gaians, the sustainability people, the permaculture people, the tree huggers, that sort of thing. That's where he's going, I think.
So he'll reinvent himself in that field.
I think so, because that's he's good at that, right? He speaks very well. His audience like him, right? He's done another book with a photographer where they've gone around Australia and taken photos, right? They're more into the Mother Earth, and that's where the publishing world's going, right? There's a huge explosion on climate books, but, you know, natural plants, Mother Earth, sustainability, that sort of stuff, and trying to get indigeneity into the school curriculum. You know, it's all this kumbaya stuff. So that's where he's got another 10 years there, I think. So he'll do all right.
Well, I appreciate you coming on tonight, Roger, to explain thoroughly the Bruce Pascoe Dark Emu phenomena, the rise and fall, and I'm sure that you'll be still continue to be ever vigilant at your website, which for everybody it's dark-emu-exposed.org. So there's a dash between each of the words dark-emu-exposed.org.
All right. Thanks very much for having me on. It's been interesting to talk. And all I want to say is, though, like, I'm actually a nobody, but I'm really, it's amazing what you can do in the modern world. If you've, as long as you're talking about the truth, right? If I was trying to talk rubbish or anything, it wouldn't get anywhere. But because we're doing the truth, we're using facts and everything, it's amazing what you can get done. So years ago, we probably wouldn't have been able to bring down Dark Emu. We would have written our letters to the letter of the editors and all would have been ignored. But in the modern world, if you're following a just cause and it's what you're doing is truthful and you put the facts out there, it's amazing what you can do. So it's good. So thanks for that.
You should be very proud of yourself. You're the perfect definition of a quiet achiever. Sure, there's the vocal people, as I said, Andrew Bolt, Josephine Cashman. There's also obviously Warren Mundine and Jacinta Price, who hopefully will be in the Senate. But you've been diligent behind the scenes, or got the ball rolling originally, which is the most critical thing. So well done on that.
Yeah, me and about 20 or 30 other normal, quiet Australians, right? So I think that's the best thing Morrison's ever done, come up with the term quiet Australian, because it actually hits the spot, you know? A lot of us are quiet, but I think we're going to start to roar a bit more, right? Get out there and do things, like with you with your program, right? And it's amazing what can happen. As long as everyone talks and builds on each what everyone else is doing, you can affect public policy, I think. That's good. All right, thanks.
Yes, it's all worthwhile, as your story shows. Take care, Roger.
Well, thanks very much. Bye.
All right, everybody, that's the Wilms Front featured interview program for this week. I do not know at this stage yet whether there'll be a Wilms Front next week, this time, or next Thursday, I should say. I'll let you know, of course, on my Telegram, Gab, Minds, and MeWe channels. I'll be back tomorrow night for Trad Tasman Talk, 6 p.m. Melbourne time on the Unshackled YouTube channel. Dewey De Boer is back. It's his on week, so I'll be in discussion with him. And then, of course, Tim's News Explosion, Monday, 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time on the Wilms Front channel. New report from Richard Wollstonecraft, report from Tiger Mountain is coming soon, so watch out for that as well. And also, keep checking out the unshackled.net for our Unshackled Productions archive, and also our articles, which I'm trying to my best to make sure that we've got a regular stream of articles and essays there as well. So make sure you check the website for that as well. And we of course keep you informed on our social media channels, Telegram, Gab, Minds, and MeWe as well. All right, everybody, thank you so much for watching. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care, stay safe, and stay positive.
Thanks for tuning in to Wilms Front. Visit timwilms.com or Rational Rise TV to view the archive of episodes. And keep visiting theunshackled.net to view all our shows. And to keep up with the latest real news and analysis.